Hello, this is Todd Durakon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 21st, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We'll start on the front page. Super outcome, an unexpected return. Super Bowl jersey finds its way home. This article's by Donette Beckett, Moequa. The walls of the Forston's Barbershop are lined with Moequa high school items and other memorabilia. Football jerseys hang next to pennants and photos. However, the collection is missing a shirt that would have stood out among the others, but really didn't belong there. Moequa barber Jay Giles was given a box of old sports jerseys, mostly blue and gold Moequa high school sports. A white football jersey, still soiled with markings from a past game, caught the barber's attention. Sewn onto the Oakland Raiders jersey was the number 73, the name Middleton, and a Super Bowl 37 patch from the 2003 game against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. After an internet search, Giles located former left guard Frank Middleton wanting to return the special shirt. But it took him a little while to respond to that, Giles said. Through Facebook Messenger, the barber asked the football player if he was missing his Super Bowl jersey. He got right back to me on that one, Giles said. Giles sent Middleton a picture of the shirt. I don't want anything for it other than I'd like to give it to you in person, Giles told Middleton. I wanted to see his face. The former football player didn't understand or didn't trust the offer. In today's world, people don't do nice stuff like that without wanting something in return, Middleton said. It made me smile. As Middleton remembers the time 23 years ago, he was told his and other teammates' jerseys were stolen from the locker room after the Super Bowl game. They gave us makeup jerseys, not the jerseys we played in, he said. I never thought about it again. The jersey found its way to Doc Bennett, whose son was working security detail during the 2003 game in San Diego, California. According to the story he was told, after the Oakland Raiders were defeated by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the football players left the locker room with towels and clothing strewn across the floor, benches, and lockers. It was pushed underneath the bench, where they sit and get dressed, Bennett said. He just saw the corner of something white. With no one in the stadium to hand over the jersey, it was stored away. After 23 years, Bennett found the bag in his home with other Moequa items. The barbershop walls were lined with memorabilia, motivating Bennett to offer the items to Giles. Maybe he could use it up there, Bennett said. When he received Giles' message, Middleton assumed the offer would be contingent on a cash exchange. His friend suggested he contact the police. This guy's trying to sell my jersey back that he stole 20-some years ago, he said. That was my thought, that he's trying to make a profit off of it. Giles reassured Middleton he wanted nothing other than to hand over the shirt himself. He never asked for money, Middleton said. Middleton still didn't trust the offer. I told him he could keep the jersey and have a story to tell, he said. He said, no, I'm going to bring it. The two men eventually met on July 11th in Beaumont, Texas, where Middleton now lives. The football player soon learned that he and the barber had similar personalities. Both are looking for adventures. I offered to repay him for a hotel and buy him lunch, Middleton said. He didn't even take that. During the Super Bowl, Middleton's hand was injured with a broken finger and lacerations. It still had the bloodstains and rips and stuff, he said about the markings. The Super Bowl doesn't have mud. That's a pretty stadium. Although he retired in 2004, Middleton's football days haven't ended. He now coaches young football players. The children may be impressed with their coach and the jersey he showed them during a recent practice. However, he plans to give the shirt to his two daughters. Now both of them get a Super Bowl jersey, he said. It's brought back some joy to the family. And there's a close-up medium-sized color photo here. A Super Bowl 37 patch caught the eye of Jay Giles at Forston's Barbershop in Moequa, and the photo is zoomed in on the patch itself. It's blue and gold and white. with the Roman numerals 37 emblazoned across. Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. And the large color photo that leads the story is of Giles holding the number 73 jersey at his Forston's Barbershop in Mowico on July 1st. And finally, a smaller color photo. Caption reads, "The 2003 Super Bowl game-worn jersey was returned to its rightful owner when Jay Giles left, met Frank Middleton on the right for the handoff. Middleton played guard for the Oakland Raiders in the game against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And Middleton is holding the jersey at about waist level, and Giles is standing next to him, and they appear to be in a restaurant. And it's just a very nice photo. Again, for Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. Local and state on A2 construction set to begin on Decatur's newest McDonald's. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. A fence and construction stakes are in place and equipment is arriving, setting the stage for construction to begin on a new McDonald's restaurant in Decatur's South Shores area. According to co-owner Andrew Birschbach, the opening date is expected to be sometime in November. It will be located at the intersection of US 51 and Southside Drive on the site of what used to be PNC Bank. Birschbach said the restaurant will include some of the newest McDonald's updates, including a first-of-its-kind play place. It's a new design and will be the first in the world to get it. The play place will look like a miniature McDonald's store with neon arches. The steps will light up when children step up on them. Children under age 3-year-old will have their own area. The new restaurant will be the Birschbach family's seventh McDonald's in Macon County and will create a presence at every major entry point into Decatur. The South Shores location will include other enhancements that cater to changes in the way restaurants operate, such as a separate door for delivery and mobile orders. It will be real easy in and out, Birschbach said. The business will initially be open 24 hours. I don't know if it'll be a great idea or a great area for 24 hours, but we'll play it by ear, Birschbach said. In the meantime, the owners are gearing up for the opening date. We'll have some fun activities when we open up this store, Birschbach said. And the small black and white photo shows geospatial surveying starts the work for the new McDonald's restaurant at the intersection of US 51 and Southside Drive in the South Shores area of Decatur on Monday, July 13th. Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review. Brian Smith hosting Brian's Birthday Bash fundraiser, Decatur. Macon County Clerk candidate Brian E. Smith is hosting a birthday bash fundraiser on Tuesday, July 21st. Brian's Birthday Bash will be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Hostetler Reception Hall, 241 North Main Street, downtown Decatur. It will include light hors d'oeuvres, special birthday treats by CM Catering, drinks, and prizes. Special guest speakers include former state senator and current deputy governor Andy Maynar. The cost is $25 per person. Checks may be made payable to Friends of Brian E. Smith for Macon County Clerk, 3569 Redlick Drive, Decatur, Illinois 62521. A lifelong Macon County resident, Smith is retired executive director for the Township Officials of Illinois. He is a former Long Creek Township supervisor and clerk and former Macon County board member and graduate of Millikan University. New York City Mayor mulls arresting Netanyahu at UN. Nicholas Williams, New York Daily News. New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani is exploring the possibility of arresting Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu when he arrives in New York City in September for the United Nations General Assembly. Mamdani told the New York Times that he was in, quote, an active conversation, unquote, with the city's law department, probing if he had legal authority to order the New York Police Department to detain the Israeli leader. I believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu belongs in The Hague, Mamdani said on a New York Times show. He's a war criminal who has been charged by the International Criminal Court. And what you will find is that is an opinion that is held by many purely because of what his actions have wrought over these last many years. Mamdani noted that he won't push for loopholes, and whatever the law allows me to do in New York City, that's what we will do. This comes after a poll found that more American Jews approve of how Mamdani is doing his job than Netanyahu, as younger and more liberal Jews grow increasingly disenchanted with the actions of the Israeli government and the war against Hamas in Gaza. A national poll of more than 1,000 Jewish Americans showed 44% view Mamdani favorably, compared to 39% who have an unfavorable opinion, the survey by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found. Meanwhile, Netanyahu was viewed favorably by 32% of American Jews, with 59% viewing him negatively per the survey. Mamdani was less popular with the U.S. public as a whole, with 28% disapproving of him, 27% approving of him, and 44% unable to rate him, according to the poll. Netanyahu was less unpopular with Americans as a whole than with Jews, with 38% disapproving of him, 20% approving of him, and 41% not expressing an opinion. Mamdani, before becoming mayor, made his intentions clear, vowing, if elected, to order the NYPD to arrest Netanyahu on war crime charges leveled against him by the International Criminal Court. Speaking last September, before Netanyahu addressed the UN General Assembly, the Democratic Socialist said the Israeli Prime Minister would be speaking to an institution which has concluded his government has committed a genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. During the course of his speech, he said, another Palestinian child will undoubtedly be killed by the Israeli military in Gaza, as they have been every single hour for nearly 2 years. From the State House, Cash Crunch Dogs, Illinois GOP ahead of 26 election. This article is by Rich Miller. Rich Miller publishes Capital Facts, a daily political newsletter, and CapitalFacts.com. The Illinois Republican Party filed its quarterly campaign finance report on the July 15th deadline. The party reported having just $223,000 in the bank. The next day, the party sent a letter to the Illinois State Board of Elections saying they were reconciling their records after a leadership change and noted that the actual end balance was $101,000 higher than it had reported the day before. But the bit of found money was basically the end of the good news for the GOP last week. Republicans no longer have a pet billionaire. Bruce Rauner and Ken Griffin have fled the state. The legions of wealthy business titans who once contributed and raised money have either retired to sunnier climes or passed away. Several prominent party members have publicly shunned labor unions and their hefty political war chests, although the state GOP legislative leaders have at least tried to rebuild ties to trade unions and even the Illinois Education Association. But the heavily gerrymandered legislative map combined with the current political climate means they'll mostly receive scraps. And yes, the House Democrats are struggling this month with scandals, including a state representative who resigned under pressure and another who was indicted. I'm not trying to downplay that at all. But Democrats have the national political environment, the local infrastructure, and tons of cash behind them. The Republicans have little to none of that. The GOP's gubernatorial candidate, Darren Bailey, raised $1.3 million in the second quarter, which ended June 30th. That sounds like a lot, but he spent almost all of that on direct mail fundraising costs. The huge expenditures do give him a prospect list for future fundraising, but he ended the quarter with a mere $128,000 in the bank. That was still a whole lot more than the rest of the statewide ticket. Attorney General nominee Bob Fioretti, a perennial candidate, raised $31,000, spent $39,000, and had $28,000 on hand at the end of the quarter, along with almost $15,000 in recent debt. Secretary of State candidate Diane Harris raised $6,000, spent a bit over $4,000, and had a paltry $1,816.42 in the bank. Treasurer candidate Max Solomon, who ran as a write-in candidate during the primary because the party failed to recruit anyone, raised less than $3,000, reported no spending, and ended the quarter with less than $8,000. Comptroller candidate Brian Drew raised $30,000 and received $47,000 in in-kind contributions from a company owned, ironically, by independent gubernatorial candidate Colin Corbett. spent less than $3,000 and ended with $54,000 and had $25,000 in debt from earlier this year. Man, that's just downright pathetic. But I suppose it doesn't really matter anyway unless we see a massive sea change in national opinion in the coming months or the federal government finds a way to not certify certain election results. Regardless of where individual candidates are at this moment, they'll have the money to compete. Unlike the Republicans, the Dems do have a pet billionaire, J.B. Pritzker, and I assume eventually for most of them, organized labor. The Republican legislative leaders have tried to scrape and claw as much as they can, but they're vastly outgunned. Senate Republican leader John Curran raised just $75,000 in the second quarter. He spent $71,000 and reported having a bit more than $3 million in the bank. His caucus committee reported having $160,000 in the bank. Leader Curran has three Republican-held districts to defend in the Chicago media market that have all trended Democratic in the last three cycles. Depending how bad things get, he could be defending a couple, two, three more. The Senate Democrats have a ton of money to do whatever they want. Senate President Don Harmon has about $20 million in his personal campaign account and $1.7 million in his caucus account. Over in the House, Republican leader Tony Macomb has at least four Democratic trending or swinging districts to defend and just $1.3 million in her personal campaign account and another $363,000 in her caucus account so far. In contrast, House Speaker Chris Welch had $11.4 million in his personal account and $1.2 million in his caucus account. Like Senate President Harmon, he has more than enough money already, but more is never enough when there's so much more out there. So those numbers will likely rise by November. Moving on to news on page A3, Will County Court's Lake Mattoon case. Judge denies pretrial release for suspect. Joliet woman charged with homicide, cover-up, and dismemberment. This article's by Felix Sarver, Shaw Local News Network, Joliet. A Will County judge has denied the pretrial release of a Joliet woman charged with participating in the concealment of the homicide death of a man whose body was cut into pieces. Judge Amy Bertani Tomczak granted a request from prosecutors on Friday morning to keep Robin Turner, 62, in jail as she awaits trial. Turner is charged with concealing the homicidal death of her husband, Delwayne Turner, 38, of Joliet, and the dismemberment of his body. Delwayne Turner's half-brother, James Adams, 26, also faces the same charges. A witness claimed Adams confessed to stabbing Delwayne Turner to death during an altercation. According to prosecutors, Adams has not been charged with that offense. Bertani Tomczak said she believed prosecutors sustained their burden in proving no release conditions could mitigate Robin Turner's danger to the public or her danger to a key witness against her. The next court hearing is set for August 3rd. The case may go to a grand jury on July 30th. During Friday's court hearing, Assistant State's Attorney Victoria Oginski said police investigators uncovered video evidence showing Adams and Delwayne Turner had brought a new freezer to their Joliet residence. Delwayne Turner's head, neck, and torso would be found in that freezer, while his other remains were found about 175 miles south in Lake Mattoon, according to prosecutors. Delwayne ended up carrying his own coffin, Oginski said. Oginski said Robin Turner told police she had to buy a new freezer because the old one was broken, but investigators found the old freezer was working and smaller than the new freezer, Oginski said. The key witness in the case said he was asked by Adams and Robin Turner to help dispose of Delwayne Turner's body, Oginski said. Robin Turner's attorney, Peter Buke, told Bertani Tomczak he didn't believe the witness was credible at all. The witness had called 911 to report what he had learned about Delwayne Turner from Adams and Robin Turner, prosecutors said. Buke said the reason for the witness's call to 911 became a major issue at trial. Buke said Buke had given Bertani Tomczak character letters of support as part of his argument for Robin Turner's pretrial release. People are there in her corner, Buke said. Bertani Tomczak reviewed the letters and later impounded them from public view. Buick said there are no eyewitnesses or forensic evidence linking Robin Turner to Delwayne Turner's death or the dismemberment of his body. What we have is suspicion, Buick said. Buick said his client is 62 and had never been arrested before. He said she has no history of violence or violating court orders. He had recommended pretrial release with electronic monitoring and home confinement. But Oginski was insistent on not allowing pretrial release for Robin Turner. These are very, very serious charges. And the investigation is still ongoing, Oginski said. On A6, the weather page, Trump's new Air Force One from Qatar is shelved again. Trevor Honeycutt, Reuters, has this article. Joint Base Andrews, Maryland. President Donald Trump said Sunday the Qatari-donated jet that serves as an Air Force One plane will soon be sent away for upgrades after questions about the plane's security features. Trump started flying aboard the jumbo jet July 1st after accepting the plane as a gift last year when an accelerated effort to renovate the Boeing 747 for presidential use began. But Trump unexpectedly ditched the plane on a flight from Turkey to the United Kingdom amid rising hostility with Iran on July 8th. He flew aboard an older Air Force One to London, but later boarded the new plane to return to the U.S. Trump was asked about whether the newly renovated airplane lacked missile defense capabilities as he returned home from a trip to the FIFA World Cup final in New Jersey on Sunday. It has a lot of capability, Trump said of the plane, but as I understand it, in about a month or so, they're going to send it to have it be maxed out. It'll take about a month. The Air Force did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The new plane, with red, white, dark blue, and gold livery chosen by Trump, was refitted by defense contractor L3Harris Technologies. It's meant to serve as a temporary replacement as Boeing struggles to deliver long-delayed next-generation Air Force One planes. Boeing is working to deliver two purpose-built 747-8s under a $3.9 billion fixed-price contract signed in 2018. That's now 4 years behind schedule and over budget. Delivery of the new plane is expected in mid-2028. The upgrades to the jet from Qatar were completed so quickly that some experts express concern that the plane may not be as secure as the baby blue Air Force One that preceded it. Critics also questioned the cost and propriety of accepting the gift. New York Times journalists who reported on the security features of the new aircraft were subpoenaed this month. The Times asked a court to block those orders to appear before a grand jury panel in Manhattan federal court. There's a very large color photo here of the new plane. President Donald Trump arrives aboard the new Air Force One aircraft, gifted to the U.S. by Qatar's government on July 1st at Joint Base Andrews, Maryland. And it's a very wide shot. You can see the limousines in front and kind of a hazy sky around. And the plane is on the runway. Andrew Harnick, Getty Images, photo credit. Television big spinoff, Chuck Lorre's Stewart fails to save the universe, brings back familiar faces. This is on the Life page on A8. This article is by Bruce R. Miller, Lee Enterprises. Before the end of The Big Bang Theory, creator Chuck Lorre had an idea for a sequel. In the back of the comic book store, there was a portal to other universes. I always wanted to work in a bigger genre than what we were doing in front of the audience, he says. Dabbling in special effects and computer graphics seemed intriguing. Lorre told Kevin Sussman to keep him in the loop about future work. He saw Sussman's Stewart as the lead in his Next Generation story. I told my wife, he said, keep me in the loop. And he was obviously just being polite, but that was nice of him, Sussman says. Lorre shared the idea with others, but didn't pitch it because he didn't think Warner Brothers executives were interested. You grow accustomed to failure, he said. No one is interested in helping you pursue this, and the company gets sold 3-4 times, and somebody else comes along and says, you know what, do that. Suddenly, Stewart fails to save the universe, has new life. Now, 7 years after the end of the Big Bang Theory, the portal is open, and Stewart and his friends Bert, Kripke, and Denise are hurtling through multiple universes in each episode as they encounter new worlds and familiar faces. Laurie and company wanted to get other Big Bang alums to appear in the episodes, but schedules didn't work out. Those who did accept the invitations played characters other than the ones they played on Big Bang. The people who got to come back really enjoyed getting to do something completely out of their comfort zone, said John Ross Bowie, who plays Kripke. Similarly, Stewart's stars were eager to step into the spotlight. On Big Bang Theory, Sussman Stewart frequently milled in the back of scenes, and since he used to work at a comic book store, I just did what I did there, took inventory, I had the clipboard, and I knew how to look believable. Now, in Stewart, he has a heavier lift and chemistry with Bowie, Brian Posehn, and Lauren Lapkus, his Big Bang Theory co-stars. There was some natural chemistry there, which was great, Lapkus said. The way the scripts unfold, I feel like we come together really well. Adds Posehn, from the first day I felt like, oh, this is going to work. I thought we'd found a wonderful balance of the four main characters, Laurie says. The only thing that changed was the stakes. The stakes are insanely high. The characters are characters we'd fallen in love with long ago. When they were on Big Bang Theory, audiences wanted to see more of them. We always said it was a strong bench, executive producer Bill Prady says. We were never writing away from a performer. You could go to anybody, and to have that experience again as a writer was just incredible. In the 10 episodes of Stewart, the foursome drops into all kinds of worlds and finds plenty of inspiration. The variety works, Prady says, because the characters are interesting people. You don't just get enough time with any of them. Or you don't get enough time with any of them. To spend time finding out about more of them, he says. The Big Bang Theory's universe is about outliers, Laurie adds. Despite enormous, sophisticated scientific minds, they were incompetent in the real world, he says. Aside from Sheldon, they wanted to participate but didn't know how, and that's universal. That's how I was able to approach these characters, because I really had no way to join them as quantum physicists. They were brilliant, brilliant minds that were struggling to be a part of everyday life. And there's a photo of the four main characters sitting on benches at, looks like, maybe an airport or a bus station. Here we go. The cast of Stewart fails to save the universe. From left are John Ross Bowie, Lauren Lapkus, Kevin Sussman, and Brian Posehn. The show follows comic book shop owner Stuart Bloom as he brings about the end of the universe and is tasked with restoring reality, along with his girlfriend Denise, geologist Bert, and quantum physicist Barry Kripke. HBO Max photos. Well, and with that, we have come to the end of the first half hour. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review.